Chapter 8. What came of Mr. Walker's discovery of the Oodjack? It is very easy to state how the captain came to take up that proud position at the Oodjack which we have seen him occupy on the evening when the sound of the fatal rava so astonished Mr. Eglanton. The mere entry into the establishment was, of course, not difficult. Any person by simply uttering the words, pint of beer, was free of the Oodjack, and it was some such watchword that Howard Walker employed when he made his first appearance. He requested to be shown into a parlor where he might repose himself for a while, and was ushered into that very sanctum where the Idney Club met. Then he stated that the beer was the best he had ever tasted, except in Bavaria, and in some parts of Spain, he added, and professing to be extremely eckish, requested to know if there were any cold meat in the house whereof he could make a dinner. "I don't usually dine at this hour, landlord," said he, flinging down a half sovereign for payment of the beer. "But your parlor looks so comfortable, and the Windsor chairs are so snug, that I'm sure I could not dine better at the first club in London." "One of the first clubs in London is held in this very room," said Mr. Crump, very well pleased, "and attended by some of the best gents in town too. We call it the Idney Club. Why, bless my soul, it is the very club my friend Eglanton has so often talked to me about, and attended by some of the tip-top tradesmen of the metropolis." "There's better men here than Mr. Eglanton," replied Mr. Crump, "though he's a good man. I don't say he's not a good man, but there's better. Mr. Clinker, sir, Mr. Woolsey, of the House of Lindsay, Woolsey, and Company, the great army clothiers," cried Walker. "The first house in town," and so continued, with exceeding urbanity, holding conversation with Mr. Crump, until the honest landlord retired delighted, and told Mrs. Crump in the bar that there was a tip-top swell in the Idney parlor, who was a-going to have his dinner there. Fortune favored the brave captain in every way. It was just Mr. Crump's own dinner hour. And on Mrs. Crump stepping into the parlor to ask the guest whether he would like a slice of the joint to which the family were about to sit down, fancy that lady's start of astonishment at recognizing Mr. Eglanton's facetious friend of the day before. The captain at once demanded permission to partake of the joint at the family table. The lady could not with any great reason deny this request. The captain was inducted into the bar, and Miss Crump, who always came down late for dinner, was even more astonished than her mama on beholding the occupier of the fourth place at the table. Had she expected to see the fascinating stranger so soon again? I think as he had. Her big eyes said as much, as, furtively looking up at Mr. Walker's face, they caught his looks, and then bouncing down again towards her plate, pretended to be very busy in looking at the boiled beef and carrots there displayed. She blushed far redder than those carrots, but her shining ringlets hid her confusion together with her lovely face. Sweet Morgina, the billiard ball eyes had a tremendous effect on the captain. They fell plump, as it were, into the pocket of his heart, and he gallantly proposed to treat the company to a bottle of champagne, which was accepted without much difficulty. Mr. Crump, under pretense of going to the cellar where he said he had some cases of the finest champagne in Europe, called Dick, the boy, to him, and dispatched him with all speed to a wine merchant's, where a couple of bottles of the liquor were procured. "Bring up two bottles, Mr. C," Captain Walker gallantly said, when Crump made his move, as it were, to the cellar, and it may be imagined after the two bottles were drunk, of which Mrs. Crump took at least 9 glasses to her share, how happy, merry, and confidential the whole party had become. Crump told his story of the Oodjack, and whose boot it had drawn. The former Miss Delancey expatiated on her past theatrical life, and the pictures hanging round the room. Miss was equally communicative, and, in short, the captain had all the secrets of the little family in his possession near sunset. He knew that Miss cared little for either of her suitors, about whom Mama and Papa had a little quarrel. He heard Mrs. Crump talk of Morgana's property, and fell more in love with her than ever. Then came tea, the luscious crumpet, the quiet game at cribbage, and the song which poor Glanton heard, and which caused Wolsey's rage and his despair. At the close of the evening the tailor was in a greater rage, and the perfumer in greater despair than ever. He had made his little present of eau de cologne. H5, says the captain, with a hoarse laugh, it smells of the shop. He taunted the tailor about his wig, and the honest fellow had only an oath to give by way of repartee. He told his stories about his club and his lordly friends. What chance had either against the all-accomplished Howard Walker? Old Crump, with a good innate sense of right and wrong, hated the man. Mrs. Crump did not feel quite at her ease regarding him, but Morgana thought him the most delightful person the world ever produced. Glanton's usual morning costume was a blue satin neckcloth embroidered with butterflies, and ornamented with a brandy ball brooch, a light shawl waistcoat, and a rhubarb-colored coat of the sort which, I believe, are called Taglianus, and which have no waist buttons, and made a pretense, as it were, to have no waists, but are in reality adopted by the fat in order to give them a waist. Nothing easier for an obese man than to have a waist. He has but to pinch his middle part a little, and the very fat on either side pushed violently forward makes a waist, as it were, and our worthy perfumer's figure was that of a bolster cut almost in two with a string. Walker presently saw him at his shop door grinning in this costume, twiddling his ringlets with his dumpy greasy fingers, glittering with oil and rings, and looking so exceedingly contented and happy, that the estate agent felt assured some very satisfactory conspiracy had been planned between the tailor and him. How was Mr. Walker to learn what the scheme was? Alas! The poor fellow's vanity and delight were such, that he could not keep silent as to the cause of his satisfaction. And rather than not mention it at all, in the fullness of his heart he would have told his secret to Mr. Mazras himself. When I get my coat, thought the Bond Street Elnisher, I'll hire of Snaffle, that easy-going cream-colored oss, that he bought from Astley's, and I'll canter through the park, and won't I pass through Little Bunker's buildings, that's all. I'll wear my gray trousers with the velvet stripe down the side, and get my spurs lacquered up, and a French polish to my boot. And if I don't do for the captain, and the tailor too, my name's not Archibald. And I know what I'll do. I'll hire the small Clarence, and invite the Crumps to dinner at the Gar and Starter. This was his facetious way of calling the Star and Garter, and I'll ride by them all the way to Richmond. It's rather a long ride, but with Snaffle's soft saddle I can do it pretty easy, I dare say. And so the honest fellow built castles upon castles in the air, and the last most beautiful vision of all was Miss Crump and white satin, with a orange flower in her hair, putting him in possession of her lovely, and before the altar of St. George's, Hanover Square. As for Wolsey, Glanton determined that he should have the best wig his art could produce, for he had not the least fear of his rival. These points then being arranged to the poor fellow's satisfaction, what does he do but send out for half a quire of pink note paper, and in a filigree envelope dispatch a note of invitation to the ladies at the Ootjack. Hour of Bloom, Bond Street. Thursday. Mr. Archibald Glanton presents his compliments to Mrs. and Miss Crump, and requests the honor and pleasure of their company at the Star and Garter at Richmond to an early dinner on Sunday next. If agreeable, Mr. Glanton's carriage will be at your door at 3 o'clock, and I propose to accompany them on horseback, if agreeable likewise. This note was sealed with yellow wax, and sent to its destination. And of course Mr. Glanton went himself for the answer in the evening. And of course he told the ladies to look out for a certain new coat he was going to sport on Sunday. And of course Mr. Walker happens to call the next day with spare tickets for Mrs. Crump and her daughter, when the whole secret was laid bare to him, how the ladies were going to Richmond on Sunday in Mr. Snaffle's Clarence, and how Mr. Glanton was to ride by their side. Mr. Walker did not keep horses of his own. His magnificent friends at the agent had plenty in their stables, and some of these were at livery at the establishment of the captain's old college companion, Mr. Snaffle. It was easy, therefore, for the captain to renew his acquaintance with that individual. So, hanging on the arm of my Lord Vauxhall, Captain Walker next day made his appearance at Snaffle's livery stables, and looked at the various horses there for sale or at bait, and soon managed, by putting some facetious questions to Mr. Snaffle regarding the Idney Club, etc., to place himself on a friendly footing with that gentleman, and to learn from him what horse Mr. Eglanton was to ride on Sunday. The Monster Walker had fully determined in his mind that Eglanton should fall off that horse in the course of his Sunday's ride. "That singular animal," said Mr. Snaffle, pointing to the old horse, "is the celebrated Emperor that was the wonder of Astley some years back, and was parted with by Mr. Ducrow only because his feelings wouldn't allow him to keep him no longer after the death of the first Mrs. D, who invariably rode him. I bought him, thinking that perhaps ladies and cockney bucks might like to ride him, for his action is wonderful, and he canters like a armchair, but he's not safe on any day except Sundays." "And why's that?" asked Captain Walker. "Why is he safer on Sundays than other days?" "Because there's no music in the streets on Sundays. The first gent that rode him found himself dancing a quadrille in Upper Brook Street to an Erty Gurdy that was playing Cherry Ripe, apostrophe such as the natter of the animal. And if you recollect the play of the Battle of Austerlitz, apostrophe in which Mrs. D acted the female hussar, apostrophe you may remember how she and the horse died in the third act to the tune of God Preserve the Emperor, apostrophe from which this horse took his name. Only play that tune to him, and he rears hisself up, beats the air in time with his forelegs, and then sinks gently to the ground, as though he were carried off by a cannonball. He served a lady opposite Apsley House so one day, and since then I've never let him out to a friend except on Sunday, when, in course, there's no danger. Eglanton is a friend of mine, and of course I wouldn't put the poor fellow on a animal I couldn't trust." After a little more conversation, my lord and his friend quitted Mr. Snaffle's, and as they walked away towards the agent, his lordship might be heard shrieking with laughter, crying, "Capital, by jingo, excellent! Dwive down in the dwag! Take Lungley! Worth £1,000, by Jove!" and similar ejaculations, indicative of exceeding delight. On Saturday morning, at 10 o'clock to a moment, Mr. Woolsey called at Mr. Eglanton's with a yellow handkerchief under his arm. It contained the best and handsomest body coat that ever gentleman put on. It fitted Eglanton to a nicety, it did not pinch him in the least, and yet it was of so exquisite a cut that the perfumer found, as he gazed delighted in the glass, that he looked like a manly, portly, high-bred gentleman, a lieutenant colonel in the army, at the very least. "You're a full man, Eglanton," said the tailor, delighted too, with his own work, "but that can't be helped. You look more like Hercules than Falstaff now, sir, and if a coat can make a gentleman you are. Let me recommend you to sink the blue cravat, and take the stripes off your trousers. Dress quiet, sir, draw it mild. Plain waistcoat, dark trousers, black neckcloth, black hat, and if there's a better dressed man in Europe tomorrow, I'm a Dutchman." "Thank you, Woolsey, thank you, my dear sir," said the charmed perfumer. "And now I'll just trouble you to try on this here." The wig had been made with equal skill. It was not in the florid style which Mr. Eglanton loved in his own person, but, as the perfumer said, a simple straightforward head of hair. "He seems as if it had grown there all your life, Mr. Woolsey. Nobody would tell that it was not your natural color." Mr. Woolsey blushed. "He makes you look 10 years younger. And as for that scarecrow yonder, you'll never, I think, want to wear that again." Woolsey looked in the glass, and was delighted too. The two rivals shook hands and straightway became friends, and in the overflowing of his heart the perfumer mentioned to the tailor the party which he had arranged for the next day, and offered him a seat in the carriage, and at the dinner at the Tar and Garter. "Oh, you like to ride?" said Eglantyne, with rather a consequential air. "Snaffle will mount you, and we can go one on each side of the ladies, if you like." But Wolsey humbly said he was not a riding man, and gladly consented to take a place in the Clarence carriage, provided he was allowed to bear half the expenses of the entertainment. This proposal was agreed to by Mr. Eglantyne, and the two gentlemen parted to meet once more at the Idneys that night, when everybody was edified by the friendly tone adopted between them. Mr. Snaffle, at the club meeting, made the very same proposal to Mr. Wolsey that the perfumer had made, and stated that as Eglantyne was going to ride Emperor, Wolsey, at least, ought to mount to. But he was met by the same modest refusal on the tailor's part, who stated that he had never mounted a horse yet, and preferred greatly the use of a coach. Eglantyne's character as a well rose greatly with the club that evening. 2 o'clock on Sunday came. The two beaux arrived punctually at the door, to receive the two smiling ladies. "Bless us, Mr. Eglantyne," said Miss Crump, quite struck by him, "I never saw you look so handsome in your life." He could have flung his arms around her neck at the compliment. "Andy Law, ma, what has happened to Mr. Wolsey? Doesn't he look 10 years younger than yesterday?" Mama assented, and Wolsey bowed gallantly, and the two gentlemen exchanged a nod of hearty friendship. The day was delightful. Eglantyne pranced along magnificently on his cantering armchair, with his hat on one ear, his left hand on his side, and his head flung over his shoulder, and throwing under glances at Morgiana whenever the Emperor was in advance of the Clarence. The Emperor pricked up his ears a little uneasily passing the Ebenezer Chapel in Richmond, where the congregation were singing a hymn, but beyond this no accident occurred. Nor was Mr. Eglantyne in the least stiff or fatigued by the time the party reached Richmond, where he arrived time enough to give his steed into the charge of an ostler, and to present his elbow to the ladies as they alighted from the Clarence carriage. What this jovial party ate for dinner at the Tar and Garter need not here be set down. If they did not drink champagne, I am very much mistaken. They were as merry as any four people in Christendom, and between the bewildering attentions of the perfumer. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.